the Dot. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, the environment, food, media, and public policy. Actually, I've been celebrating something past the three-decade mark recently in just the last month or so. And this show is now going on into its sixth year, and every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between all of the different facets of our world that impact us, our communities, our society, and the ecological balance of our habitat, planet Earth. And so for over five and now going on well into 6 years now and Connect the Dots, we've been talking with different experts, advocates, thought leaders, activists, scientists, authors, journalists, and filmmakers about a whole range of different facets that connect our world. You know, in this society, a lot of us, you know, a lot of people are specialists, but actually we live in a complex world where we really need generalists and people who look at the interconnections between the different things that show up in our world, and help us overcome the overwhelm and gain insight, understanding, and point the way to the right action, for ourselves and our times and for all on Earth. And that's why on today's show I'm really, really pleased to bring back some guests that we've had before, who are among my very top favorites. I say this, I mean, I'm, you know, I've had extraordinary people on this show and whom I really honor and respect and feel so grateful to engage with and bring their wisdom to you listeners. But there are some who really I closely follow, who really educate and influence my own understanding and positions on various things that I cover both on this show and also through my articles on Alternate, EcoWatch, TruthDig, and on my regular blogging on my Facebook page. And I'm just going to take a sip of water. Apologies. Our two guests today are really people who are leaders whom I very much trust, who are out ahead of the curve. They are Kevin Zeis and Margaret Flowers. I first became aware of Margaret Flowers, who's an MD and a pediatrician, through her single-minded advocacy for single-payer health care at the critical time that health planning was being undertaken in this country, with mixed results because it couldn't go far enough. Many physicians kind of sat on the sidelines. Margaret Flowers stood out from the crowd and stepped right into a leadership position, which has continued until today. She, as well as Kevin Zeis, whose extraordinary work as an attorney and an advocate in the political realm, has created tremendous leadership in the fight to understand and oppose the TPP and other trade deals, which is how I came into closer connection with them and followed them more closely and brought them on this program. Kevin, along with Margaret, co-directs Popular Resistance, which is a terrific newsletter, and actually I hope someday to do some writing and be a contributor there, because I think their work is just terrific. They have done so much to not only inform but to orient people to challenging times, with many things that are excluded from the mainstream media, not only excluded but maybe covered in misinformation so that people don't even grasp some of the things that are going on. They also have originally founded an organization called It's Our Economy, and they have a terrific radio show, Clearing the Fog, of their own. And so they joined me last winter, and as we were talking about the TPP and other trade deals and their possible progress to a vote in Congress, which we can also discuss somewhat on today's show. But they're also very deeply insightful in, as I've followed their work in the current election cycle, where there is so much division, confusion, you know, and pain, really, around some of the things that have evolved. that they, with their strong background, have seen coming. Kevin, in particular, has been very active in the past in independent and third-party political campaigns, and so, you know, and also the misinformation and, you know, attempt to stifle them that have gone down in our country. So we're going to talk today about the election cycle, the primary cycle, third parties, the trade deals, and a whole bunch of stuff. So, you know, stay listening. This is going to be a terrific show. And welcome back to Connect the Dots, Kevin and Margaret. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us.
Quite an introduction.
Well, you know, I really, really value your work so much. And one of the things that, you know, we're standing at a very strange juncture in our country. And one of the things that's so difficult is that people are defining that juncture, where we are, how to go forward, and what we need to be focusing our attention on for a positive outcome at a time when our democracy, such as it is, which many people have become very disillusioned with, which some people still hold high hopes for, you know, where it stands, where it's positioned right now, what we can do, like what the pathway forward is, and I think it's essential to get there, to first define where we actually are, and then we can talk a bit about why this is so hard for people, you know, to perceive. So your perspective, where, what is going on in this election year? What is at stake? Where are we in our democracy today?
I'll let Margaret start out.
Okay, thank you. So as you mentioned in the introduction, we tend to take kind of a bigger picture, a longer term view. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing now with the nomination of Donald Trump as the presidential nominee for the Republican Party, and Hillary Clinton will be the winner for the Democratic Party. These are the two most disliked candidates ever for a president. They have very high negative approval ratings. And so to me, this really is kind of the culmination of decades of people engaging in lesser evil voting, or voting out of fear against what they want, you know, against what they don't want, as opposed to what they actually want. And we see that in terms of the polling data, that people who are, majorities of people who say they're supporting Donald Trump are actually voting against Hillary Clinton, and vice versa, majorities of people who support Hillary Clinton are actually voting against Donald Trump. And then we place this in the context of the bigger picture, where it, in addition to that, the two major parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, are actually shrinking. They represent, you know, 21% of registered voters are Republicans, about 29% are Democrats, and about 50% are other. They're independents or third party or unaffiliated. So I think what we're seeing is that people are really starting to get in a very big way, or there's a national consensus building around the reality that the two major political parties don't represent us, and that we need to build something alternative in order to kind of get the changes that we really need. And so I think this opens up a really big space this year for third-party candidates, and it's exciting to see kind of how those are starting to gain in the polling and in terms of their membership as well. And I'll let Kevin jump in at this point.
Well, you know, we have an impossible task as people trying to put in place a progressive government that actually represents what the people of the United States believe. If you look at polls, that's where people are. And it's an impossible task because we have two jobs. One is to defeat Trump, the other is to defeat Hillary. So it's not an easy choice. How do we do both?
Mm-hmm.
And really, since the Nader 2000 race, the Democrats have been very effective, with the help of their friends in the mass media, at putting out this view that a third-party race is a spoiler. And the reality is that throughout our history, third-party races are not spoilers. They may not win, but they are the creators of the kind of country we want. That is what that, those are the, where the seeds come from that lead to women getting the right to vote, that lead to monopolies like Rockefeller's oil empire being broken up, that lead to unions, workers getting the right to unionize and to have an 8-hour workday and a decent pay. That led to the New Deal. That's the roots of that came out of the progressives and socialist parties. So we're not spoilers. We're creators. And we have to start to really change our mindset and realize that the only way we're going to get what we want is to vote for what we want. We've been voting a lesser evil since 2000. People, I haven't, but a lot of people have been voting lesser evil since 2000, since that propaganda campaign. And it was a myth campaign because the reality is Al Gore lost more than 200,000 self-described liberal voters in Florida, 200,000. That he lost them because he ran a terrible corporate power campaign. He was a corporate mm-hmm. Democrat, member of the Democratic Leadership Council. He was always voting for war throughout his history. So he was never the progressive that people wanted at that moment. That we were at a phase where we would be normally moving toward a more progressive majority. You had the 1999 Seattle protest. The movement was there, but Gore was not the representative of the movement. And so he ran a terrible campaign, losing 200,000-plus liberal voters in Florida, and they blamed Nader, who got like 20,000 liberal votes in Florida. You know, so it was an amazing, great myth, a great fraud, and it's affected people's voting ever since. You still see it on discussions, on people involved in discussing how do we vote this year. And the thing that makes this an even more free year, if we can recognize that freedom from understanding what really is the history of the country and that 2000 was a myth, what also frees us is looking at the Electoral College map this year. Hillary starts out with 245, 247 Electoral College votes. All she needs to win is Florida. She's ahead by double digits in Florida. This race is already over. If you look at the so-called battleground states, there's eight of them that they're listing right now. Hillary is ahead in all of them. There are only really a couple that are under a few percentage points lead for her, Iowa, New Hampshire, Ohio. Otherwise, there's really no battleground states. And as we know, the presidential election is 50 state elections, statewide elections to get electoral college votes. It's not a national election, so these national polls that will fluctuate constantly and really don't show the true image of what's going on is these, you know, small number of battleground states that matter, and Hillary's ahead in all of them, many of them by double digits, very few of them by under 5%. So this election is not going to give us Donald Trump. It's just not going to happen. The Brexit vote doesn't change the Electoral College map. So we're free to vote how we want, and it's about time for us to start to vote for what we want. And that's obviously Jill Stein this year. There's no question she's the right on the issues. And if we build her up, she's at, some polls have her as high as 7% already, which is 2,000% higher than where she finished in the last election. It's higher than where Nader was most of the time in his elections. If we support Jill Stein's campaign and she builds up, she gets the 15%, she's in the debates. And in the debates, she reaches 60 million people. And then our message gets out. That is the victory of
the
year. The
debates 4 years from now, you're saying, Kevin, just to be clear?
What's that?
The debates 4 years from now, in other words, in the next...
No, I'm not talking, I'm talking this year. If she's at 7% now and we people rally behind her, if the Sanders voters don't vote less or evil, but vote for Hillary, vote for Stein, she could be at 15% this year. And that could mm-hmm. dramatically change the debate in this country. Her voice, she'll be more of an impact as a voice than Sanders was, because she's actually even more correct on the issues than he is. She's not just calling for tuition-free college. She's calling for erasing student debt. She's right on all the military issues. She's opposed to the ongoing wars. Sanders is very mixed on that. So she's even right on the issues. And so I think she'll have a bigger impact in the debates than Sanders had in the primary. So that's the key. She's at 7% now. Get her 15%, support her, vote for what we want, and we can get what we want. And that's, and we can go through a little more detail the history of this and how this has worked in throughout U.S. history. But that is how we win. And it's always been a two big business party duopoly in U.S. history. That's always the way it's been. And so we've had to, as political movements, we've had to work to have an impact in a very manipulated election system. And we've done that successfully before. There's a way to do it. But right now we're being fooled by this lesser evil nonsense, and we have two evils we got to stop.
Let me just back up a second and ask you a question. Bernie Sanders has never formally conceded, although he has stated before the entire run that he would not leave the Democratic Party, and his statements since California are all to the effect of working within the Democratic Party to get a new wave of progressive candidates elected, running for office and elected. So, you know, there still is, he goes into the Democratic Convention, which is coming up in just a few weeks' time. I mean, just about, you know, a little more than 3 weeks away right now. Not having conceded, he has, he's clearly also made it a priority to influence the Democratic Party platform, although, you know, that isn't going so well.
Right.
Because he, you know, he was allowed to name some, you know, platform
members to the platform committee.
But he's, but he's overruled by numbers before they even begin. And they have been voting straight up and down the line with no deviation to defeat, you know, nearly all of the key proposals, and certainly the ones that I cover and am most concerned about, namely the trade deals, climate and fracking, which really are life and death questions for planet Earth, for our lives and the lives of many other species on planet Earth. Planet Earth may endure without us, but it won't be with us if we keep, you know, going down those particular roads. So let's, you know, what is your view of what Sanders is attempting and, you know, what he is trying to do at this juncture? And, you know, if you had had a crystal ball, how does it look to you? Because there are some who are still hoping that he would come out of the convention and sort of lead off into a third party. That's one hope. Or, you know, there may be other hopes, such as that various things like the email controversy or a possible you know, recount in California might actually result in his gaining the Democratic nomination. So, can, you know, what are your views on those various scenarios and where we are now?
Well, I hate to be so a downer for Sanders supporters, but I don't see any way he wins the nomination. She really has overwhelming numbers of pledged and superdelegates. There's no movement of the superdelegates towards Sanders of any significance. Maybe one or two have, but more of Sanders supporters who were superdelegates moving toward Clinton. And the California recount's not going all that well. It's shaving off a little bit of lead, but not turning things around, so I don't expect that's going to happen. The potential indictment for the email scandal or for the Clinton Foundation scandals, which are real scandals, there's, there's no indication that's happening before the convention. And so I don't, I mean, he can, I think if he wants to, you know, obviously the platform fight's going pretty lousy as well. So I don't see much hope for that. And I think the idea that you can change the Democratic Party from working inside it is a mistaken one looking at U.S. history and the history of the Democratic Party. This has been tried before. We just did a radio show on these issues, Clearing the Fog Radio, which is also part of the Progressive Radio Network. And, you know, our guests, we have two guests on who are very strong historians on these issues, and there's no evidence that you can change the Democratic Party from the inside. In fact, quite the opposite. When the unions tried to do this in the 40s and since, even though they controlled almost a majority of workers at one point, now they're down to barely, you know, single digits if you don't count public workers. They're a dying movement, and they're dying because they allied the Democratic Party. If they had instead, in the 1940s, decided to build a labor party and been spending the hundreds of millions and you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and hundreds of millions of volunteer hours, so-called volunteer hours, that they spend on working for Democrats, building their own party, they'd be much more powerful today than they are now being part of the Democratic Party. So the same thing with the Civil Rights Movement. you know, that M. Martin Luther King was very smart to stay out of the two parties, not pick a party, seeing both parties as problematic and trying to be the conscience of both and pushing them both. That was my position. After he died, the Civil Rights Movement made the mistake of aligning with the Democratic Party. Got a lot of people elected, but the Democratic Party got more conservative, and the civil rights, the life of African Americans in this country has not improved since the Civil Rights Movement aligned with the Democratic Party. Same with the peace movement, the women's rights movement, the environmental movement. We need to, these movements have to recognize that the Democratic Party is a big business party funded by Wall Street, funded by the militarists. That's where it gets its money from, and that's where it presents. Their rhetoric, that sometimes sounds friendly to our issues, is rhetoric. The reality is they put in place policies that hurt us. Even when they say they're helping us, like with the health care law that Obama did, they're actually hurting us. They've made health care more expensive as far as premiums go. They've made health care more expensive as far as out-of-pocket costs. They've narrowed the cost so that leading cancer centers often are not included, so you have a pre-existing illness with cancer, but you can't go to the cancer center unless you want to pay for it yourself. So, but that helped the health insurance industry. They've been able to become more monopolized. There are less health insurance companies now. They've made bigger profits in the stock market. They're doing fine. They get $150 billion a year, in subsidies from the federal government. So they're doing fine. So Obama's, you know, rhetoric about helping the people was rhetoric. The reality was they hurt us. And that's how the Democrats always are. People need to understand we need to leave the Democratic Party. When you talk about movement change, the goal is to shake the power structure, to weaken the power structure. The Democrats are part of that power structure, working inside the party, even for a brand new Congress. If you're just Democrat, you're wasting our time. You got to work outside the power structure, build an alternative structure, and that's the task. Now, the Green Party has only been running presidential elections since 2000, so it's a young party. Don't judge it like you're judging the Democratic Party's power, which has been around since the founding of the country. You can't make up, you know, 200-plus years in 20 years. So the Green Party, as a young party, is doing what it can. People should join it and it'll do more. It represents the issues the movement stands for, and that's where people's votes should go. You're wasting your vote when you vote for part of the power structure, and that's the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, I'm a long time, I come from, you know, multi-generational Democratic Party members, and I'm sure there are many people in the country in this same boat. And but one of the things that really kind of shocked me in the whole Sanders primary election was the fact that so few Democratic Party elected officials, like just a handful, were able to endorse him or work with him. It was like he was running as a Democrat, but there was an absolute lockdown in party loyalty, and I almost felt that people, obviously the Democratic officials were doing this from their own self-interest to protect their relationships, their capacity to get money for their campaigns, their ability to work with other Democrats. But there was absolutely, for a party that, you know, which many perceive from the side of its greater liberality on domestic issues, you know, like women's rights and now this, the guns and violence and all of that. This is not a play well with everyone. A Democratic elected official has the freedom to go, you know, step in any way away from the party line. And that's what we've seen. It was uniform everywhere. Huge amount of very congealed and rigid loyalty with no flexibility. It's like a party line, like, you know. And that, I have to say, truly shocked me. That meant that, for example, when there were election issues in my state, New York, and elsewhere, the people occupying roles from the Democratic side could not be counted on to be fair-minded in any way. They could be counted on only to do anything in the interest of their, at that point, very presumptive candidate, but, you know, the one that had been agreed to behind closed doors before even a vote occurred. And so the lack of flexibility and that rigidity really doesn't give any options for different pathways, disagreements, different solutions. And I think we're also seeing that rigidity reflected in the division among Democrats between the Clinton and Sanders supporters, you know, where it's almost like two different views of the universe exist. And it's really hard to dialogue around them because everyone is a proponent of their own view. And, you know, it does not show the kinds of, it doesn't show flexibility, creativity, ability to build community and consensus, you know, all of the good things that we would associate with democracy, the democratic process and the thriving of democracy in this country. So I have to say that I count myself among the very disillusioned with that party following this, and for those reasons. Margaret?
I think that was another positive of the Senator Sanders, you know, run for president, the Democratic Party, was that he really showed kind of the rigged nature of it, the fact that it's really what we have right now is kind of a mirage democracy when it comes to the nominating process for our presidential candidates. The Democratic Party nomination process is even less democratic than the Republican one because of the way that they stack the primary races, you know, so tightly together, and that means that only the really big money candidate can you know, be able to be in enough states to win. The way that they use the superdelegates to kind of be able to control the nomination process, and I think that, you know, we've seen that over time through history where these kind of insurgent or more progressive Democratic candidates run, you know, like Jesse Jackson, like Dennis Kucinich, Howard Dean, and, you know, they don't really have a chance because they're not the establishment party's choice candidate, and really the party machine can decide who that person is, and that's the reality. I think Sanders knew that going in. I think that he chose to run as a Democrat because he, you know, correctly guessed that would be a way for him to be in a debate to reach more people. I think he shocked himself and others by being able to go as far as he did and raise as much money as he could. But those who are within the party, they already knew ahead of time who the favorite candidate was going to be, and that's why either they didn't endorse anybody, like Elizabeth Warren waited until just this past week to endorse Hillary Clinton, or they did endorse Hillary. Even, you know, after California, Senator Sanders' close allies in the Progressive Caucus, like Raul Grijalva, endorsed Clinton. So I think that they saw, they knew where that was, where that train was going, and they wanted to make sure that they had their, you know, most favored status there. But this, you know, this kind of rigging of the process is something that we've seen for a long time, and it's why, you know, another one of the reasons why trying to change the party from within is just not possible. We've seen this happening for the past 100 years where different groups attempted to change the party from within. And certainly I think that, you know, the point that Kevin made was that, you know, you had groups with times when there was a very strong labor movement, very strong social justice movement, and they tried to change the party and didn't have the power to do that. So why would we think that we would have power to do that now? I think that's why it's really important for us to understand that our power comes from working outside the party, because when there's no alternative, you know, then it's very easy to manipulate people. If they only think their choices are Democrat and Republican, then you can use the fear-mongering scare tactic to force people to vote against something scarier and for something they don't even want. But when people have a choice, when they have somewhere to go, their votes can't be taken for granted. Their votes must be earned. And so even when third parties don't win, they still change that power dynamic. They change the conversation. They make the parties have to at least try to work for their votes. And if we look at the kind of long-term picture of this, what we're doing is building the alternative that we need by voting for what we want and strengthening the Green Party and other left parties. And I think we also need to find ways to have the parties on the left work more cohesively together to kind of really unite more people on the left, more people that are progressive. Over time, as we build that up, it will bolster our work and our social movements as well. And if we look back to the most successful third party in our U.S. history, which was the Republican Party, which came out of the abolition parties, that took decades to build up to a point where the Republican Party won against the two major pro-slavery parties, the Democrats and the Whigs. And I think that, you know, if we look now, the issue back then was slavery. The issue now is wealth domination of our political system and corporate power dominating it. And we can't change that by voting for two pro-corporate parties. We need to build the alternative over time. And even if we don't win, keep building that until we get to the point where we do.
Well, let me ask you a bit of a devil's advocate question about that, because, you know, the assumption, the hope that we have several decades to build something, to build what you're describing, how does that stand vis-a-vis the trade deals, which, you know, if the TPP were passed as part of, you know, a Clinton hurrah, you know, we beat the horrible Republicans and now we're going forward and hey, folks, you know, we recommend the TPP and, you know, I know that people are getting more and more informed. But if we have a scenario where the TPP passes, you know, were to pass, and I know we're hoping, we're all working for that not to happen, and we can talk more about the trade deals and why, but, you know, what is the utility of a third party building over decades in the scenario that those horrible deals pass, which bring in global corporate overrule, really?
Mm-hmm. This is always a problem because during abolition, you know, slavery was also we can't let these people be enslaved forever. I mean, so this is always a problem. And but unfortunately, if you're going to use a political solution, you're not going to solve that problem by voting Democrat. And the Democrats see people coming to support, especially like, you know, Hillary puts in Tim Kaine as their vice president, who voted for Fast Track for trade agreement, who is a member of the Democratic Leadership Council. You know, so if she picks him and she wins, that's a signal that they should go ahead with the trade deals. So I don't see how voting the alternative for Trump. Timothy Kaine from Virginia, Senator Kaine, who voted for the trade deals. For the fast track for the trade deals, you know, he would be a signal that trade doesn't matter. And but in Hillary's support trade deals most of her career, she just reversed herself on TPP in this election, and hopefully she will stay that way. But the key is this on trade deal. You don't just win an election. You build a mass movement. The trade movement has been incredibly strong against Obama and the biggest business interests, most of the Republican Party, and the DLC corporate Democrats. Even with that allied against us, we have slowed them down, forced them to reveal the text of the TPP, put them into an election year to deal with it when they wanted to deal with this 2 years ago. The movement against these trade deals is stronger than it's ever been. We are going to stop this trade deal. Even Barney Frank, who has become a mainstream Democrat, you know, wrote an op-ed last week saying they should not consider the trade deal in the lame duck session. That passing the lame duck session may be a short-term victory, but it will be a long-term loss because it will prove what everyone thinks. We're an oligarchy. We're not a democracy. And so he opposed that, which was a surprise coming from Barney Frank. So the movement is winning. And we have to not just focus on elections. The most important thing is not elections. The most important thing is the movement. We change the political culture. The movement changes the political culture, which results in making space for people like Sanders to run an election. And he's been saying the same thing his whole career, but he could not have run this election without the political movement creating the political space for it. So the movement is the most important thing. The movement is winning victories. It's going to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership and show more power. And that's going to make more political space for anti-trade or potential candidates in the future. So that's where the power comes from, is the movement is first. Elections are a tool we can use. We know elections in the United States are managed very carefully. And, you know, to your earlier question that you mentioned about Sanders, how unified elected Democrats were against Sanders. I mean, even people thought were progressive Democrats. They're aligned because they know their party represents Wall Street. They are funded by Wall Street. They need Wall Street money. 31 state Democratic parties reached an agreement with Hillary Clinton's victory fund before the first primary vote to do joint fundraising together. I mean, how corrupted and, you know, conflict of interest can you get when 31 state parties, which is pretty much where the Democrats only have significant parties, because a lot of states are just Republican. The Democrats don't have a 50-state, you know, party, really. So most of the Democrat state-level parties ally with Hillary on fundraising before the first vote is held. That is how you know the party is going in that direction. When Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a co-chair of her national campaign in 2008, is the chair of the Democratic National Committee, what hubris to throw into our face that a Clinton co-chair is the head of the party, all the state parties are aligning financially, and all the elected officials are aligning with Clinton. This is a foregone conclusion. Now, it looked easier to Sanders, and he did very well working inside the Democratic Party. That's an easier path, it seems like. But it's a dead-end path. The slower path, the more difficult path, is building our own alternative. And it, as Margaret said, it took 20 years of abolition parties to destroy the divide the Democrats and destroy the Whigs in the 1840s and 50s and make room for Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party, which was a kind of a weak abolition party. It takes that amount of time to build something in this electoral system. And I know time's not on our side on climate change. It's not on our side on lots of issues. But working inside the Democratic Party is not going to change that, because that's not going to solve. They're not going to solve the climate change issue. They're funded by big energy. They're funded by Wall Street investors. So unless there's profit in it for Wall Street, they're not going to face up to climate change either.
So I hope that
One other thing I want to mention: Margaret Flowers is running for U.S. Senate in Maryland as a Green. Flowersforsenate.org. It hasn't been mentioned. I think people should go to her website and support her campaign. She's a very important spokesperson for the popular movement, and having her have a strongest run possible against Chris Van Hollen, who's a corporate Democrat, formerly the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, a top fundraiser for the Democrats from Wall Street. He's already raised $9 million, which is absurd in the U.S. Senate race in Maryland. Margaret Flowers for U.S. Senate. Check out her site, flowersforsenate.org, and help her out.
Thank you.
Add quickly, I think that the point that I want to build off with, you know, what Kevin was saying is that what I hope, you know, people take away from this experience, in addition to the fact that we need to build alternative parties, is that that the social movement is really critical in determining, you know, we're concerned about the trade agreements, we're concerned about the climate crisis. We're not at this point going to be able to elect the person who's going to be a leader in that. And so it's up to us as people to take that leadership position. And so just as we've, you know, over time have been building this strong movement to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there's a strong climate justice movement that's building. We're all working globally, you know, interconnected in ways to fight for the changes that we need. That's the work that's really critical at this moment if we're going to continue to try to deal with the climate crisis and to stop these agreements. And so in addition to our other work, we're organizing something called the No Lame Duck Uprising. We already have almost 3,000 people that have signed up, about 1,000 people who said they're willing to come to Washington, D.C., and others who are going to be organizing locally. We're calling Congress weekly now through our Fight the TPP.org tool to tell them to stop the lame duck. We don't think that there should be a lame duck. There's a precedent for not having them. And this is a very anti-democratic time, and not when they should be considering really significant controversial pieces of legislation like TPP. If they go forward with the lame duck, we plan to be there in Washington in November to protest that, to stop them, as well as people acting locally in their communities to put pressure on their members of Congress. And then I think that we need to also have the mindset that going into the new year, we as people need to be organizing to demand what the political agenda be, to not let the elite set that agenda, but for us to set the agenda. And so there are efforts through the People's Revolution to create a people's platform. They'll be meeting before the DNC on that Saturday, July 23rd in Philadelphia, and then doing ongoing work to define that platform. The Green Party has an excellent platform. It's been crafted over 20 years. It continues to evolve through a very democratic grassroots process. And so I'm actually also the honorary co-chair of the Green Presidential Nominating Convention in Houston in August. That's certainly a place that people are welcome to come and participate. So I think that the message has to be that beyond the election, we have to find ways in our communities to come together and mobilize and realize that we need to set the agenda. And that's what's happened in the past. I mean, when Richard Nixon was president in the 70s, you know, he created the EPA, he created the Occupational Safety Hazard Administration. These things came from, you know, popular power pushing for these changes. There was strong labor and environmental movement, you know, the women's rights movement, the anti-war movement, East after the Vietnam War. So it's really, people have more power. We have to recognize that we have that.
Margaret, I just want, since you're mentioning these various movements, I want to raise another question, which is the role of the recruitment of women and the recruitment of, you know, feminist language to the Clinton campaign, you know, with the sense that that many women, more likely older women than younger women for sure, have that electing Clinton is an achievement and a step ahead, you know, for women overall and for feminism and, you know, dealing with misogyny, violence, and all the rest of it, because there are powerful voices coalescing women around the, you know, the promise. There's the potential that Senator Elizabeth Warren could be the vice presidential candidate. And, you know, so the image, you know, the sort of the photo image of two women campaigning together and, you know, fighting off the demon Trump is a powerful draw for many women. And I know that, I mean, for me personally, because I'm, you know, of the older generation, it has really divided my generation. And, you know, it's kind of irresistible for many women that don't follow the issues that we're discussing or the movements that we're discussing and who are, you know, kind of more at, you know, the latter part of their life, and they have been powerful voters for Clinton and are also at this juncture, you know, kind of have been recruited to that whole position and aren't, you know, and have kind of dug in there. I'd love to hear your perspective as a woman and as a senatorial candidate on
right,
that.
And our presidential candidate is a woman, and we have, you know, many strong women that are running this year. We have over 150 candidates running Green Party in the United States this year, and a very diverse, you know, a diversity of candidates, which is really important, I think. We published an article this past week on popular resistance called The Hegemon of the Harpies, and it kind of looked at some of the women leaders over the past few decades and really looking more in depth at, you know, are they truly representing feminine values, or are they just kind of a female extension of the male kind of patriarchal oppressive war, you know, kind of policies that we've had. And I think that while it's tempting to have, you know, it's exciting to have women running, the possibility of women winning, I think we have to look at, do they really reflect our feminine values of what we would like to see in office? And I you know, look at Hillary Clinton's positions and over time, you know, her, in particular, her foreign policy decisions and what happened in Libya and, you know, and other countries, and kind of that violence, that disregard for the innocent people that were killed in those struggles, her economic policies, which have ravaged particularly lower income and communities of color. I don't think those represent the kind of feminine values that we want to see in office, and certainly not the kind of values that Jill Stein or I or other women candidates running in the Green Party would like to see going forward. So it's unfortunate, because it will be very easy to persuade women who don't look deeper and who will be touched by that kind of emotional appeal that will be made by the Hillary Clinton campaign about how representative this is of the struggle for women's rights. And I think that our struggle for women's rights has to be that we're able to fight for the values that we have as women, as well as, you know, just our gender.
It's interesting how that kind of thinking of you had to vote for Obama because he's African American, he's over Hillary because she's
right.
a woman. I mean, it's like, you know, and we make fun of the Kurds and the Shiite and the Sunni for voting based on their religious views. I mean, it really is not a very smart way to vote. I'm sorry. I know that I'm glad we broke the barrier on African Americans in presidency. I'll be very glad to see a female get to become president. But I don't want a Margaret Thatcher. I don't want someone who's going to lead us into World War III because she's so belligerent with Russia and China. You know, she's the author of the Asian Pivot. She supports the surrounding of Russia with NATO troops. She wants to do aerial blockade over Libya while Russia's in the air. I mean, this is like a very dangerous person looking to create conflicts with major powers. I'm sorry. It's not clear when she's a lesser evil when you look at it that way compared to Trump, who, you know, is all over the place on foreign, like every issue, on foreign policy. And has said some of the smartest things about Iraq that any candidate has said as far as criticizing it goes. So, I think it's important for us to vote on the issues, what someone stands for, what their track record is, not based on their gender or race or ethnicity. Next will be Latino. You have to vote for the first Latino president. You know, I mean, it's a manipulation. This is how the game is played. This is manipulation of voters. This is not facing up to the central power of the era, which is people power versus corporate power. We have to be challenging corporate power every chance we get, just like the abolitionists had to challenge slavery every chance they got. I would have voted for the abolitionist candidate in the 40s and 50s, so 1840s and 50s, even though they didn't have a chance to win, because that was the right position. I'm going to vote against the corporate candidates in this era because that is the key position to stop the destruction of the planet and undermining the people by corporate power.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree and feel the same way, but I am constantly being besieged by people who, come to my Facebook page, longtime friends of mine, who are completely, and I hate to say this, and it's a horrible kind of thing to have to say, but I sometimes have felt, and in fact, I think a lot of my own reporting has been to engage and empower women to not flee from politics, not flee from social action,
right.
Because there are big and overwhelming infrastructures, and so there is a whole tendency among at least the women of my generation to kind of want to have the psychological and emotional responses. I like Obama. I'm fearful, and this is too much to handle. I'm afraid of Trump. You know, because women have different, really, neurology, and not everybody has the extroverted personality, the kishkas, you know, the the guts or whatever for debate and contention, the vision and the information, because women are focusing on juggling their jobs and families, and their kind of bandwidth is full. I think we've done an extraordinary job of informing everyone about the trade deals because, you know, the initial tendency on that was basically twofold. One, from a female point of view, what do I know about trade? I think a lot of people felt that way. And secondly, Obama is our friend. You know, he couldn't
right.
be doing this. So those are two emotional, gut-level, psychological responses. And, you know, women have been, you know, as the carriers of kind of emotional sensitivity or whatever, have validated themselves, and rightly so, around honoring those responses. And yet those very responses, can lead us astray because, you know, it can be exciting to see, you know, women campaigning until you really look at what the record of the woman in question is and what that woman is going to do going forward. And there's also this the role of wishful thinking and hope, or, you know, that one, because she's a woman, that one could communicate, one could persuade her, one could talk with her, she's just like me, and therefore, you know, she'll listen to us, you know, all of that. And I'm speaking really from the position of communication challenge around this, because in my own writing and in my own communications work, I try to bridge the factual understanding that we do in journalism of what someone's record actually is. You know, right now we have a situation, for example, where Clinton is ostensibly, despite her long history of being a proponent of the trade deals, she's nominally opposing it in the current election, which is, you know, while her platform committee has shut it out. So here we have a two-faced, confusing presentation that is inconsistent. And, you know, I think this also induces confusion in the public, because anyone could pick up either side of that. Someone could say, oh, well, she opposes it now, and I hear this all the time, and, you know, I'm sure you do too. One is constantly refuting that. And on the other hand, someone else can say, her platform committee just shut it down. And to me, that, you know, I would emphasize that, and that's very telling. And so what I hear back in these kinds of dialogues is that a lot of people, a lot of it is interpretive, and people will come down and say, well, I don't think she's as much in favor of them as she was, or, you know, and they might regard that as being a product of influence from the progressive side. You know, the very thing that we're saying, you know, build a third party to have a strong progressive voice, some people will see the progressive voice of Bernie Sanders out there and the response to his, you know, attacks on the trade deals. People will say, well, she's moved because of us.
So yeah, well,
go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. You asked a question there.
Well, I mean, how to address the misinformation and confusion and psychological identification?
It is a massive, massive challenge, because the United States is one of the most propagandized countries in the world. We get the most sophisticated propaganda of any country in the world. The people who are in power, part of the system that holds power in place, the Democrats, the corporate media, the Republicans, are experts at manipulating the media and the views of people. So we have a very big challenge. I think a lot of the work that you do, that we do, that the Progressive Radio Network does, and other independent outlets do, is central. I think there are more people right now aware of the lie of the Nader myth of 2000, more people who are aware of the reality of Hillary Clinton's history, you know, on a lot of these issues than ever before, because we have a growing alternative media that is reaching more people than ever because of the Internet. So, you know, winning the battle on net neutrality that we were part of was a critical fight to make sure that we can have an alternative media. Again, there's no quick fix to these problems. It takes building. It takes building a movement that is independent of the two parties, that is consistent in its views, does not compromise, does not limit itself to what the Democratic Party wants, but really fights for what the right answers are. It takes building our alternative political party, which is a multi-decade-long process, going quicker than I expected when we see that nearly half the voters now are independents. That's a major sign that we are doing a great job of building the alternative, because people are getting tired of the two parties. That's a big step. And same thing with media, building the alternative media. These take time, and it takes persistence, and it's not a quick fix, you know, soundbite game. It's a long-term effort that'll last longer than all of us on this planet, the three of us on this planet, because the fight for justice is not an ending fight. It's an ongoing fight. And so what we're building now will help people 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And that's the reality where we are. So don't expect a quick fix. Accept the reality. We have to be persistent. We have to fight battles now and win battles now, and we'll win battles more and more. It's incredible, the victories of the Black Lives Matter movement, the blockades of gas pipelines. And I'm not just talking about KXL, but lots of pipelines and export terminals are being stored across the country on issue after issue. I could keep going of giving you examples of tremendous victories. And I think we're going to win the TPP, which will be a really big one.
And I think that I just wanted to add that, you know, the fact that these conversations are happening, and I know, you know, we spend some time on Facebook as well and are having them as well. I think that in all of the work that we do, it takes time for this awareness to rise up and for people to, you know, to gain greater clarity. So the fact that we're having these discussions is really critical. And don't be dismayed because somebody may not get it. It takes, you know, sometimes it takes multiple times of hearing a message before it really clicks, or an experience that helps it to click. But we've seen, you know, through our work, I know Kevin has in particular around the drug war, because he was fighting the drug war back when it was very popular. People supported it wholeheartedly. And over time, he's seen that reverse, you know, full circle. And we see it on other issues as well. We just have to keep having these conversations, hanging in there, being patient, trying to reach people where they are. And, you know, I think that over time we are seeing it already moving and people becoming more aware. And we just need to continue to do our work to help that along.
Thank you. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, what about the fact, for example, you know, I really came along from being a health journalist and a health reporter to looking at the pollution and of toxic chemicals, and from there to the negative impacts of industrial hazardous chemicals used in fracking, and became, you know, the first news cycle reporter covering fracking, and really an embedded reporter in the New York fractivist movement. But one of the things that I know from working with that movement, which, you know, I've now been doing for 8 years at this point, and that's always ongoing and core, you know, to what I'm involved with, is that a lot of the, and maybe this is what you're talking about, but a lot of the wins that we've had have entailed hammering on our Democratic governor, who is never a person that, you know, anyone would have pictured to be a stand out in front and lead the parade on environmentalism. Speaking of Governor Andrew Cuomo, but we have basically built from our side alone, and it's really through the work of all of the organizers and activists, filmmakers like Josh Fox, who has been a guest on the show and will soon be again talking about his new climate movie, which just is showing on HBO for the first time this week. But, you know, a lot of the efficacy of the New York movement has been, it's kind of developed a relationship with that governor. And so even among fractivists in New York, I think everyone coming out of the gate 100%, that I know that's really been part of that battle has been, you know, for Bernie Sanders and all of this, for all of the obvious reasons that anyone who is really environmentally aware would have to be. But at the same time, oh, I think we're coming down to our show close here. Well, so much for that question. To be continued. I want to thank you, Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, for being my guest today and Connect the Dots, and from this excellent and terrific conversation. Folks, go to Popular Resistance and Margaret Flowers for Senate to keep track of their work and support Margaret's run for the Senate. And thank you for being with me today.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. And thank you, listeners. Come back next week at 10 a.m. Wednesday Eastern Time for the next Connect the Dots on Progressive Radio. I'm Allison Rose Levy. The tree that crawled alive.